Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we bring you a report about a plan in South Africa to bring a new language into classrooms. But first, Cameroon is experimenting with Africa's first mobile system to send a cardiac or heart signal over a wireless network. The system will give much-needed medical assistance to heart patients in rural areas. Cameroonian Arthur Zhang invented the device called the CardioPad. He was just 24 years old when he invented it. The CardioPad is a touchscreen medical tablet that enables heart examinations to be performed. The results of the test are sent wirelessly to specialists in other parts of Cameroon who can interpret them. Simplice Momo is a 55-year-old heart patient in a rural area of Cameroon. He says the CardioPad saves him time and money. He says it is too costly and difficult for him to see a heart specialist in the city.
It's been about a year now. They said I had cardiovascular disease. I've been traveling to the city to take treatment. But since they brought these machines, they just put the machine inside me, so I no longer travel to the city, which it was expensive for me before.
Cameroon has a population of about 22 million people, but the country only has 40 heart surgeons. Most are in the cities of Douala or Yaoundé. Sometimes the heart experts needed can only be found outside the country. Apollonia Budzi is a nurse at St. Elizabeth Cardiac Center. She says the device will permit doctors to send patients' medical information to specialists in Europe.
You know, we don't have a resident surgeon, so we have various teams coming from Italy, from France, Sweden, Germany, and other places. So we are not working on a daily basis. We collect the patients and then program and then call the people up to come and operate.
Arthur Zhang started the CardioPad project 5 years ago. The young computer engineer said he needed more training and $45,000 to develop the device. His family did not have the money. Banks would not give him loans. So he shared his idea on social media. The president of Cameroon, Paul Biya, answered the appeal with money for the project. Mr. Zhang also received free online training from an engineering school in India.
When I decided to design the tablet at the electronic level, I didn't have the knowledge because I am basically a computer science engineer. So I decided to learn myself electronic by online video. So I go on the internet and I discover a free education program provided by the Indian Institute of Technology. This is how I learn electronic online.
The Cameroon scientific community has recognized the CardioPad as extremely effective. The device cost about $4,000. The government of Cameroon has not been able to provide the device to hospitals in need. Most of them lack internet and enough electricity. But the CardioPad testing at the Bafia Hospital is gaining attention and may get the assistance needed. Mr. Zhang says he has had private investors contact him, but he is more interested in investors who share his vision. That vision is not of money, but of better ways to help improve people's lives. You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. South Africa has 11 official languages. If you want to say hello, it's Sawubona in Zulu and Hallo in Afrikaans. Now, South Africa's school children may start using Ni Hao to say hello. The country's education minister says the nation is adding Mandarin language teaching in some schools. Bob Doty has more.
Mandarin is the official spoken language of China. That country is a major trading power for South Africa. A recent agreement between the two nations centers on 5 areas of cooperation. They include development in basic education, school books and lessons, mathematics and science, teacher training, and career education and research. South African officials have not said how much the teaching Mandarin will cost. Troy Martens is an official with South Africa's Ministry of Basic Education. She says the new partnership is extremely valuable.
So it's very exciting, and both countries have indicated that for them education is a high priority, and that's why education is high on the agenda of collaboration between the two countries.
The part of the plan that has gained the most attention is the inclusion of the Mandarin language in schools. A public opinion study last year found that South Africans have mixed feelings about China. The survey showed 46% of South Africans do not like the spread of Chinese ideas and customs in their country. The results also showed that 60% dislike Chinese music, movies, and television. But Ms. Martin said Chinese trade is more important than those feelings. She said it is extremely helpful to learners in South Africa to study Mandarin as well as Chinese culture. And she said not every school will offer Mandarin.
Now, this won't be compulsory, it won't be for every school, and it won't be for every child. But for schools that feel they have the capacity to offer Mandarin as a subject, we think it's a great opportunity for South African learners to be exposed to, you know, this international type of language.
South Africa's population studies do not say how many native Chinese speakers are among its nearly 51 million people. Lisette Noonan heads the 80-year-old Pretoria Chinese School in South Africa's capital. The school serves about 500 students from kindergarten to grade 12. Every student studies Mandarin. Ms. Noonan says the school welcomes the new cooperation between South Africa and China. She said it is in the best interests of children to study Mandarin. She said that is especially true with China becoming what she called a huge economic power in the world. South African schools suffer from the country's history of apartheid. I'm Bob Doty.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. The Indonesian human rights activist Munir Said Talib was killed 10 years ago this month. Today, his death remains unsolved, but not forgotten. Indonesians are now preparing to swear in a new president. The governor of Jakarta, Joko Widodo, was elected to the position earlier this year. Munir Said Talib died at a time when civil rights and freedom of speech were suppressed in Indonesia. The activist helped to uncover evidence of the military's involvement in human rights abuses in East Timor and Aceh. He accused high-level members of the State Intelligence Agency of involvement in two deadly military operations. One involved the kidnapping and disappearance of student activists during the riots that led to the resignation of former President Suharto. But speaking truth to power proved harmful. Munir was given arsenic, a poison, while traveling to Amsterdam on September 7, 2004. He died before his Garuda Indonesia flight landed in the Netherlands. It was unclear if he was poisoned on the flight or during a stop in Singapore. Many believe those responsible for his death have never faced justice. Munir led the Indonesian human rights monitor Imparsial before his death. Three individuals from Garuda Indonesia were found guilty of charges linked to the murder, but many people believe the three did not act alone. Some activists claim that those accused were acting on orders from the National Intelligence Agency. They point to evidence of telephone calls and visits between one of the jailed suspects and the deputy chief of intelligence at the time. But during legal hearings, activists say, evidence was suppressed and some witnesses withdrew their statements. Activists point to a United States diplomatic cable from 2007. The WikiLeaks website published the cable. It said witnesses claimed the former chief of the State Intelligence Agency chaired meetings at which Munir's assassination was planned. This month, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry made a statement about Munir's killing. In his words, "Full accountability for all those allegedly involved remains elusive." But some Indonesians say the new president is unlikely to reopen the case. Alexius Jamatu heads the School of Political Science at Pelita Harapan University.
The culture of impunity is so strong, it's massive, and I don't think that he has the ability, he has the experience in order to face such a huge challenge, because for me it is like changing a tacit agreement among the elite not to investigate all these past human rights violations seriously as we might expect or United States might expect.
During his first term as president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono set up an independent team to investigate the case. Activists are urging the president-elect to make the results of the investigation known after he takes office. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Now the VOA Special English Program, American Stories. Our story today is called Mr. Black. It was written by American reporter Charles Kuralt. It is from his book, A Life on the Road. For many years, Charles Kuralt traveled across the United States, telling interesting stories about Americans. His stories were broadcast on the CBS television network. Later, some were published in books. Here is Shep O'Neill with Mr. Kuralt's story called Mr. Black.
George Black was a brickmaker. He mixed dirt and water, poured the mixture into forms, and heated the forms until the mixture was hard. During his life, many structures were built with his handmade bricks. George Black became a pretty good diplomat for the American State Department, too. But that part of his story comes later. George Black's father died in 1889. George was 11 years old. His brother was 14. "We will not be able to go to school," his brother said. "We are going to have to work for a living. If we work hard and make men out of ourselves, even if we do not know the difference between A and B, people will call us Mr. Black someday." George repeated his brother's words proudly more than 80 years later. By then, he was a very old man. Everybody called him Mr. Black. The two little boys, George and his brother, set out on their own in 1889. They walked the 40 miles from their village in North Carolina to the nearest big city, Winston-Salem. They worked for a brickmaker for a while. After they learned how to make bricks, they started their own business. By the time I met George Black, he had been making bricks for a very long time. He still used the same method. He tied a mule to what he called a mud mill. The mule walked slowly in a circle, turning the mill. The mill mixed dirt and water, creating the wet mud from which bricks are made. Mr. Black gathered up the mud in his big hands and put just the right amount in each form. It was then ready to be heated in a hot fire. Each form made 6 bricks. "How many bricks do you think you have made in your life?" I asked him. "Oh," he said, "I do not know. I would be afraid to know. I made 1,000,000 bricks one year. Mr. R.J. Reynolds wanted to build a tobacco factory. He asked me if I thought I could make 1,000,000 bricks. I studied and said, yes, I could. I did, too. You can go see them if you want to. That building is still there. They are all my bricks. Yes, sir." I found myself filled with great respect for this man. He was standing in a hole in the ground, covered in mud. He had made a life of earth and water and fire. He had made the building blocks of a city. The next day, Mr. Black put on his best clothes, and we walked around Winston-Salem. "These bricks we are walking on," he said, I made these only about 40 years ago. He pointed with his walking stick. I made the bricks for that church over there. I made the bricks for that wall. Wherever we walked, he pointed out the work of his own hands. When we reached the huge tobacco factory, he spoke again. I believe I told you wrong about this job. It was not 1 million bricks. It was 1.5 million. Made them 6 at a time, for $1.50 a day. That was good pay in those days. Yes, sir. Made all these bricks 6 at a time. And I am going to make some more yet. I told the story of George Black on television. The day after, I found myself talking about him again. An official with the United States Agency for International Development was interested. I hear you had a story about a brickmaker last night, the official Harvey Witherell said. Yep, I answered. Oh, gosh, he said, I have been looking all over this country for a brickmaker who still does the job by hand. I did not think there were any left. You see, the government of Guyana has a plan to rebuild the country. It does not want a big brick factory. It wants somebody to go from village to village to teach the people how to make bricks for themselves. Well, I said, I know the right man for the job, but remember that he is 92 years old. I do not care how old he is, Harvey Witherell said. He must be the last person in America to make bricks by hand. Give me his address and telephone number. Mr. Kuralt, you have made my day. I called Mr. Black to warn him what was going to happen. He said he had already received a call from Washington. Where is Guyana? He asked. It is in South America, I said. My, my, he said. The very next day, Harvey Witherell flew from Washington to Winston-Salem. He and Mr. Black liked each other immediately and quickly reached an agreement. Mr. Black would go to Guyana for 10 days. He would take his granddaughter. She also knew how to make bricks. A young boy would go to help them. Mr. Black would be paid $100 a day. Harvey Witherell said, This is a wonderful thing you are going to do, Mr. Black. We, in Washington, thank you very much. Mr. Black said simply, I believe you have chosen the best man to do the job for the USA. Harvey Witherell knew what had to be done. He prepared a detailed proposal. He developed a plan and an emergency plan. He organized every hour of Mr. Black's trip, every visit to every village, every meal. He completed all the necessary documents. He was unbelievably excited. His big project was moving along smoothly. Mr. Black was excited, too. He had never been far from home. Now, he was about to travel to a foreign land as an official representative of the United States of America. I was excited myself. I had visited Guyana as a reporter a number of times in the past. I would now be going back again to report on Mr. Black's trip. As I waited to hear when we would leave, disaster struck. A high official with the Agency for International Development read the proposal. Something, he decided, was not acceptable. He canceled everything. Harvey Witherell called me almost in tears. They say Mr. Black is too old. It did not seem fair for Harvey's big idea to die this way. I did my best to make him feel better. Too bad, I said. Yeah, too bad, he said. It was over. That is, it would have been over. Right then, however, we learned how one part of the government does not always know what another part is doing. Mr. Black, naturally, had told a lot of people about his trip. Someone at a newspaper in Winston-Salem heard about it and said, "That is a good story." And the story appeared on page one of the paper. Next, someone at a national news service read the Winston-Salem paper and said, "That is a good story." And they sent it to newspapers all over the country. Then, someone at the White House read about it and said, "That is a good story. It would be wonderful if the president could see Mr. Black before he goes to Guyana." So on exactly the same day that a government official was canceling Mr. Black's trip, a White House official was inviting him to come to Washington to meet the president. The project became of top importance. All the wheels of government that hours before had rolled backward to a halt now started rolling forward again. So, George Black got to meet the president. He got to go to Guyana, too. There, he taught brickmaking with such energy that everyone around him was tired. One of them was probably the government official who said he was too old for the trip. I have not collected many objects from all the years I was on the road as a reporter. But from the story of George Black, I have two. The first is one of his bricks. It is solid and strong, like the man who made it. The second is a photograph of President Nixon in the Oval Office, surrounded by Mr. Black and his family. In a corner of this photograph is the small face of a man wearing an expression of victory that day. It is the face of Harvey Witherell.
You have just heard the story, Mr. Black, by Charles Kuralt. It is from his book, A Life on the Road, published in 1990, by G.P. Putnam Sons. The story is copyrighted. All rights reserved. It was adapted for Special English by Christine Johnson. Our narrator was Shep O'Neill. This is Shirley Griffith.